G'day everyone, and this is Mitch Docker now talking to you from Life in the Peloton. And of course, I'm joined with Lionel Burney, and it's bloody great to talk to you, Lionel.
Hello Mitch, it's great to hear you actually speaking to me rather than coming through my speakers from the Tour de France coverage where you made your Tour de France and cycling podcast debut, travelling with Richard and Francois and Kate for the week. And I have to say, really enjoyed, and I had no doubt that I would enjoy your contributions, but I really enjoyed your contributions. And you had a lot more success in the mix zone talking to the riders than I do. I can't work out why they would stop to talk to you more readily than they do stop to talk to me. But that's one of life's mysteries.
I did have a lot of fun in the mix zone. It was really funny. And Richard kept saying to me, you can't do that. You can't, you know, troll the riders. I'm like, why not? That's just what I normally do in the bunch. So this is exactly the same, except the best part is I don't have to race with them until sort of 2 weeks' time in Tour of Poland. It was just a really great experience and really eye-opening to be on the other side of the fence. Very fatiguing. You know, I have to admit, as much as I wanted to say it was an easy job, the fatigue caught up with me in a couple of days. Very different fatigue to a high-level sportsman, because what we do is, sure, it's very fatiguing, but it's a very intense way and you get a lot of recovery. But what you guys do is it's a slow burn. It's up early, it's to bed late, and it's just a slow burn. And I tell you what, my body was not attuned to that. It wasn't accustomed to it. So I was wrecked. I was bloody wrecked. I was trying to do a few rides and I wasn't really performing that well when I was riding, but I did enjoy the fresh air and I saw that side of the beautiful side of exercising in such a job.
Just to, for any listeners who don't know the term mixed zone, let's explain. I mean, it's your first time on the other side of the fence, as you say, Mitch, but after the finish or at the start, there's a mixed zone where the journalists all wait in their little pens, all fenced in. You have to go in the one that's allocated to your nationality, don't you? Or the nationality of your media. So I guess you would have been going in the UK, US, Australia box, and then the riders come to you and you can either speak to the press officers and set up a chat with a rider, or at the finish it really is like hailing a cab in the rain in New York, isn't it? You have to get your arm up and yell across the street to get someone's attention. And that's why for us journalists it's very easy for the riders who just want to get back to the bus to just sort of look the other way or pretend they haven't heard, whereas Mitch, you know, they all know you from rubbing shoulders with you in the peloton. So that was why you were having a bit more luck. But the whole world on that other side of the fence, the from the mix zone to the press room to you know, the types of hotels that we stay in, I guess pretty different to what you're used to.
Very different. And I found out the hard way, if you don't have one of those golden lanyards, as in the Tour de France lanyard with your pass on it, it's very difficult to get anywhere at the Tour de France. Very tight security. And as a rider, you're not really that used to that, because, you know, the doors are always open in front of you and obviously you expect to be able to get where you need to go. And that was quite different too, you know. Excuse me, mate, you can't come in here, you know, type thing. And yeah, obviously they didn't say it like that, but it was very eye-opening and, you know, a little snippet into the future life, which I know is not too far away, but before then, I've still got some racing coming. And even before that, we've got another podcast up. Life in the Peloton is back on track. And this time, I spoke with a teammate of mine, Magnus Cort Nielsen. He is from Denmark. And he was actually a teammate of mine back on Orica Green Edge. And we had a couple of years apart where he moved to Astana and I moved across to EF. But in a couple of years after that, he came across to EF, which I was very happy to be back with him because he's a great guy, very Danish. And as you'll know what I mean, if you listen to the podcast, they've got, you know, he's very direct. He knows what he wants, very calculated. And that's what I love about him. His career is very calculated. His decisions are very calculated. And a lot of the time he's spot on with his calculations. So I guess without further ado, Lionel and I'll have a chat at the end of this episode too. So hang in for that. But sit back and enjoy this one and a little insight to where Magnus has grown up on a small island just off the shore of Denmark. Well, here we go. Here we are. We're back racing. I'm here at, I like to call this race Route de Sud because that was the name of this race when I first raced it, but it's actually called La Route d'Occitanie, and I'm sitting here with one of my teammates. I've actually been on the team with this guy, two different teams. So, long-time teammate, welcome to the podcast, Magnus Kort Nielsen.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I've been looking forward to this moment when I would be invited.
Getting the call up. But you got to tell me how to say your name properly, because in English, we don't say it correctly. How do you say your name in Danish?
Yeah, in Danish, I say Magnus Kort Nielsen. But I think Denmark is such a small country, so already from school, we learned to pronounce our names a little bit differently in English.
Speaking of small countries, let's speak about where you're from. And I know you've just done, many people ask you about this. Once they find out this tidbit of information, it's the thing that a lot of people talk to you about. It's your island. Magnus was brought up on an island, and the island is pronounced Bornholm. Well, that's the way I say it anyway. A small Danish island in the Balearic Sea, just off Denmark. Tell me about the island. Tell me about what it was like growing up on an island, because the island is only 40 k's north to south, 30 k's east to west, and about 140 k's in circumference. So it's pretty small. What's it like being like full islander? Maggie, what was life like on the island, Bornholm?
Yeah, it was a nice childhood. It's not like a really, really crazy small island. It's big enough to have many different schools and towns. I think in Denmark, we have a lot of islands, and this one is the largest island that is not connected with a bridge. And then it also is far away from the rest of Denmark to the east. So actually, the nearest land we have is Sweden, and to describe the position, it's pretty much north of the German-Polish border, actually.
Because when I was reading up, I did a little bit of history on it. It's actually been like invaded a little bit with Sweden. It was it Swedish at some point, and then it was Danish, and then what happened during the war as well? Tell me a little bit about the island. Tell me some history about it. It's a pretty interesting little place.
Yeah, a lot has happened and has changed also over the years back in history. First of all, Denmark is one of the oldest countries in the world, so there's a long history. And
is that fact, is it?
Yeah, one of the oldest, yeah.
What are the oldest? Do you know off the top of your head? Because you're quite a knowledgeable guy, and I'm assuming you do know what the oldest. What are they? Give us the top five.
No, I don't know. I think that's a hard one also to define when exactly do you call something a country, and when is it the region growing into a country. Okay. And it goes back a long way, and Denmark used to be a lot bigger than it is now. And that's also one of the reasons that the island is lying so isolated, because the south part of Sweden has been Danish, not for the last 350 years, but before that. But the island ended up staying Danish. It was also invaded by the Swedes. But yeah, a brave Danish guy rode down on a horse and shot the Swedish general in the back.
And is that brave you call that, shooting him in the back?
Yeah, he kept or got it back on Danish hands. Yeah, and as late as Second World War, I think it was a pretty interesting time in history for Bornholm, because we got it was the Russians that freed us from the Germans, not the rest of the Allies with the British and Americans. And the German general, he didn't want to give up, so they had to bomb pretty heavily the Russians, the island, and afterwards they stayed for almost a year. So even though
the Russians
stayed, yeah. So even though the war was over, people were going around and being nervous for a long time if the Russians would like properly stay and make it into a bit of Russia. But finally they left too.
Did you have any family there at that point?
No, I didn't. So it would not have influenced me. My family have moved over later.
So tell me how you guys ended up, as in the Kort Nielsen family, ended up on Bornholm.
Yeah, we are a bit against what's actually been going on for the last many years. A lot of people have been leaving and less is coming. But my family has been coming from my mom's side. Her parents moved over there. I think they found it as a really nice place, and then she found my dad and brought him with me and got their kids and now actually also my dad's side of the family has moved there, so I have pretty much my whole family.
I did notice that because I saw back in 1965 the population was about 48,000 and now it's around about 42. So over those years, I know that's a long time and it's only whatever it is, 6,000 or whatever, but people have been leaving. You said that. Is there any real reason why? What's been going on with that?
Yeah, a lot of young people is leaving. Naturally, they if you want any longer education, you have to leave. You can get a basic education there, but there's no universities or anything like that. So then you leave, and for a long time, people did not end up coming back. Some would come back when they were having kids, like my mom. She also left, but then brought the family back over. And then you will have people coming back again when they retire. So you have a lot of retired people, old people, and families with kids. But in the gap from 20 to 30, there's really not many people around, including me. Yeah. I have left and it's not living there.
Well, let's talk about that leaving, because from what I understand, you started writing at the age of 12 with your father. And I want you to talk a little bit about this. But when you got to the age of 16, you also left to pursue the sport of cycling at a sports school. Tell me a little bit about that time between the age of 12 and 16, where, from what I understand, you were doing a little bit of everything. You're doing a bit of mountain biking, you're doing a bit of cross riding, a bit of road riding. How did that love for cycling start to formulate on the island? You know, was it your dad or was there a good culture there? How did cycling start for you?
Yeah, I always did a lot of sports growing up, track and field and running in particular, and I got a road bike when I was 12 at the same time as my dad. We both got one.
Oh, your dad wasn't riding yet?
He wasn't riding. He liked it. And we had done occasionally in the summer on good days just some rides on our town bikes. Obviously, like rest of Denmark, cycling is in the culture. And I've always had a bike and enjoyed it. Yeah, we got both a road bike at the same time and starting riding a bit on that. Only trips, no racing. But slowly I got into racing both. At that time there was only one club on the island, but they had a few races. Not any big races. I would race with maybe one or two other guys in my age group. And then we would race with the guys from maybe 50 to 60 or whatever was kind of suitable in
same speed.
Same speed, yeah. So we were starting the bunch race with six guys maybe.
Is there many roads there? Like, is it good to train there?
Yeah, it's really good because it's pretty small. You don't have any big roads and there's not much traffic and you have a lot of small roads. Denmark is really developed with the farmland, so you have many farmers' roads. But they're with tarmac on, and so you have so many roads still. There's roads there that I don't really know exactly where they go.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you would have known all the roads there.
Obviously, I will never lose where I am. But
you seriously haven't ridden every road there?
No.
It's only 40. It's only 100K around. How could you? Like, it's only 40K, 30K. It's actually a lot of roads.
Yeah, there's really a lot of roads. Uh-huh. If you're in there on the small roads in the fields, many parts, every kilometer you can take a new road to cool. Left or right. So it would be like small roads, and maybe I've been on most of them, but for sure many of them I don't remember exactly what's lying around the corner.
So tell me about this next phase of life, because this is a big step for anyone to move away from home, but you went across the sea to Denmark, to mainland, to go to a sports school, to pursue your study alone. Your mum and dad were still back on the island. Tell me about that next period. Was it to follow the dream of cycling, or was it just to get better education? What was that purpose of that move for you to go across to Denmark at that point?
The particular school was to focus on cycling. But it is quite a big thing in Denmark that when you are those 15, 16 years old, you do your last year in school before, I would say, maybe probably like high school. Then you would do that at a school away where you live, and so you get many new friends.
Boarding school, man.
Yeah, probably kind of. You just do 1 year, some do do 2 years there, but many of them have a theme. So usually it's not something elite, but you can have musicians or pure football schools. But this school I went to had a few different branches, but was serious in the direction of sport you were doing. So I was a bike rider. So they have. I was purely only like riding my bike as the extra sport I was doing.
Were there other people pursuing cycling at that school?
Yeah, we were, I think, 15 cyclists, and two of them were girls. And then the other sports was dancing and soccer, handball, golf. I think that was the sports.
Are there any riders who have come through that school or were in your class that we know today?
Not from from my generation or from my year. I think Emil Vigneborn, Assos Quebecer, he's been there later.
Wow. So, yeah. Oh, there we go. All right. Well, cool. So you were there. And was that difficult at that point, at 16 years old, to go away? Or were you just like, bit of freedom, bit of fun, you know, boarding school, pursuing your dream, cycling on the mainland? Was that the sort of feeling, or you were a bit sad to leave home?
No, in the beginning it was really nice. I think later on, the last couple of months was getting hard because obviously I was still doing a year of school, so there was a lot of homework there, and combining it with the cycling just took a lot of the energy out of me, I think. So in the end, I wasn't so much involved with the whole social life, which is also a big part of being there. But yeah, I got through it, and actually went to a different school, also with a bit of the same theme, but instead of doing normal school, it was focused on being a bike mechanic. That's education in Denmark, and that was a bit easier, the school side. So we have more time, freedom, and more energy to relax and enjoy ourselves. And because that cycling school was, we were only 12 guys, so we were going in the normal class with the rest of people wanting that same education, but we got left out at one. We could go out and do our training.
Would you train together, one big bunch, or you just go off on your own?
No, we would train together. We had a coach there coming with us every day.
Oh, that's cool. I can't believe that. It's so foreign for me to think, like, in Australia, you have cycling and just be like, all right, see you guys, I'm going to go training now, just cruise around the city. You know, is that the feeling? Was it like that, or was it really serious?
No, I don't know.
It was doing efforts mixture and fake races and things like that.
Yeah, we were doing. It was full on. We had we had training program from the coach there, who was also a mechanic, was teaching the older students. But that was a really good time on that second school. I really enjoyed that. It was also a little bit better because we only had one training session a day, where the first school, in order to fit in with soccer and handball and most other sports, I think you often train twice a day. So then the training sessions was split up. That's a bit hard for cycling. So we would sometimes get up early in the morning to get 2.5 hours of training instead of 1.5. And sometimes in the afternoon we could be allowed to miss out on one lecture, maybe to do a longer training. But then we have to do that in the evening. But on the second school, we could leave at one and do one long ride. So that was a lot better.
So tell me about, when was this idea formulating for you, potentially like, hang on, I could become professional here, or I want to become professional, or this life of a pro cyclist, this is something I really want to do. Was that something that you were feeling? Because like, what I see is 2011, things were coming together. You won the junior national title on the road, you won the junior national cyclocross title, so you were getting a touch, people were understanding who you were as a rider on the national level. So this idea, I guess, at that point was presenting itself like, oh, maybe I can follow this dream, maybe I can be a pro, maybe, I don't know. Was this idea coming to you, or you was just doing it for a bit of love at this point and schooling, and it was you like cycling or sport? When did this idea for you come to be like, I want to be pro?
Yeah, for sure. In 2011, it was there. I don't know exactly when it came before. I think it grows maybe a bit more from being a little dream as a kid until your things was going well. the older you get, and when you're still on track, then it maybe gets a bit more like a serious dream that you can actually believe in, instead of just thinking, oh, I'll be the next Messi when you're 5 years old. I think a lot of kids is dreaming about that. Yeah, but for the 2011 season, I changed my focus to the road. From doing a lot of different sports, I slowly transformed into cycling, but then my main focus had been mountain biking, still doing a bit of road. And for 2011, I changed over to be focusing on the road, and that paid off really well.
Because you beat Craig Anderson in the junior title, I saw. Is that true?
Yeah, we came in a small breakaway to the finish, and then I beat him in the sprint. So that was great. He was riding for
that was great. Yeah,
he was riding for the biggest junior team. You have teams in Denmark as juniors. They had been dominating and winning all. We have like a cup in Denmark as well. They won every single race in that cup, except for the nationals when
were
I
they,
won it.
Were they really aware of you, or were you a bit of an unknown guy at that point?
No, they knew me because I'd also been with a national team, and I won actually the peace race, I think the biggest stage race for juniors. So I think my name was pretty well known as juniors, also in Europe.
Well, that was when I started to get to know your name. Just before you signed professional with Green Edge, there was this rustling around of the best amateur, well, best under 23 coming through was you, Magnus. Because when you joined Colt Energy Team, you know, the first year 2013, and then especially 2014 when you really were on fire, I think you had 10 wins that year. Or something around there, was it?
Yeah, I think UCI wins, and then obviously a few wins in Denmark and other places. There wasn't the UCI races.
And you attracted the attention of Green Edge. Tell me about those 2 years at Colt, because we're fast-forwarding a little bit here, but it seemed like things were really clicking, and you were really going through the gears very quickly, and quickly became one of the most sought-out neo pros for the following year, 2015. Tell me about those couple of years at Colt there.
Yeah, I had my first year as 123 in 12, which was going all right. I didn't win anything, but already in 13, I took two professional wins in two stages of Tour of Denmark. So that was a huge, not only for me, but also for the team. I was the first continental rider ever to win a stage.
Is that right?
In that race, yeah.
Cool.
Jakob Fuglsang here, he won the race overall, obviously many years earlier, but that was without winning a stage. Yeah, and since it has been done by other Danish riders.
Yeah, but you were the first. I like that.
And already in the end of that, or I think after Tour of Denmark, I actually got offer from this team back in the... What was it called? Garmin.
From
Garmin.
Yeah, right. From this team. Yeah, EF. So yeah. It was called Garmin. Yeah, actually, it was called Garmin then. Yeah,
the Garmin team.
In 2012.
No, for the 2014 season.
Yeah,
after
okay.
the 13, my two first professional wins. So I was going well, and I think some guys they turn pro as soon as they can, and for sure it was also tempting for me to do so, but I got advised to wait a year there.
Who advised you on that?
Both my team manager at that time, and also the national coach under 23, who was my also my personal trainer. And I was talking with my dad. And
what were you thinking at that point? Were you like every other young guy going, I really want to go, I really want to go? And but these guys were saying, look, you should wait. And you think, I respect these guys, I'll listen. Or you were already thinking, I don't want to go. What was your thought in that time?
Yeah, obviously I had many thoughts. I think I was listening a lot, also because Denmark had before I turned pro, a bad history of a lot of talents turning professional and then only getting the first or maybe one or two more contracts, but not like having a full career and not any big results. So that made me want to wait. Also, it was only my second year under 23, so even if I had a really bad year the year after, I would still have one more year to make up for it in the under 23 category, which is where you kind of want to be turned pro in your under 23 career. Mm. That's a little bit easier. You have the window of the Nations Cup to show yourself off in, and I think if you're older than that, yeah, then you have to take the contract. But I was so young, so yeah, I thought I can wait one more year. And it paid out really well. I had many big results the year after. And
it was a big step, wasn't it? You know, and it felt like the first year was like, great, I'm feeling good. But then, you know, the second year was like, okay, now I've found my straps, and almost like you were ready to make the step to the professionals year after.
Yeah, I think so. It turned out pretty well coming to Greenwich, where you also were my teammate. I think for a couple of reasons, I was living on my own in Denmark already, so I was used to that part. I think that can be hard if you, probably the same for Australians, if you're used to living with your mom and dad on a lower level of cycling, and suddenly you move to a different country, you don't speak the language, you live alone, you have a big team, you don't know anybody. It's a lot of new things at the same time. But for me, it was a smaller change. The last 2 years on Kult, I was already only cycling. I didn't have any schools or studies or work besides. So I was used to having that as my only focus for the day, and also living by myself.
When you think back to those times and the steps you made, are you ever in a position to give advice now to young guys coming through? Because I see it as a very mature sort of thinking in those times. Like you spoke about, many young guys, when given that opportunity, jump at it. This is my chance. I'm going to go. Sometimes the window does close, you know. But like you said, you held strong. You knew you still had time. You had the confidence in yourself. And even that second thing you mentioned there is living out of home and experiencing that. And when you made the jump to the World Tour, you weren't doing all those steps at once. Now I'm big time pro. Now I'm living away from home. Bang, 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 you know. Are you able to ever pass on this advice to young guys coming through now, the young Danish guys, or you haven't had that opportunity yet?
Not that I don't want to pass it on, but I think I don't know many of them, actually, because quite quickly they grow older. There come new young guys up that I've never raced with, and since I don't live in Denmark, I don't see them or know them. Yeah, sometimes you just have to jump at the opportunity also. I think if you're a little bit older than I was, then even if it's a small pro continental team, that's maybe the only chance you have to get a leg inside, and then you have to take it and hope for the best. But yeah, if you are first or second year under 23, I think you should almost always wait. We see now the last few years have been some really young riders coming through and doing well on the World Tour, so for sure that's also possible, but there's a risk that there could be too much at one time.
Yeah. Let's talk about your first year in Green Edge, because I remember, and this is something that I love about your personality, is this is just an exterior thing. It could not be true. You can tell me if I'm wrong here. It seems like to me you're very calculated and you've got things worked out that you know work for you. You're like, okay, I know what I'm going to do and I know that works for me. That's the way I'm going to do it. And I'm going to tell a little story here the first time I experienced this. Magnus rocks up to the first Green Edge training camp. And he's a Neo Pro, and we're out in Australia. And in those times, the team was bringing out the new guys to Australia. The team had been existing for a couple of years, so they said, anyone who's new on the team, Europeans, come out to Australia, we'll show you Australia, you'll do a Mitchelton winery ride and all this sort of stuff. We're at this training camp, and we're up in Bright, going up the mountains and stuff. And Magnus was just Neo Pro, it's December, or whatever it was, November. And he's like, no, it's November, and I'm going to ride it 200 watts or whatever it was, and that's what I'm going to do. He didn't get caught up in the game. He didn't just follow the wheels of the big riders or the guys that he thought were good big old pros or whatever. I better just stay with these guys as long as I can and impress them and get dropped. He's like, no, this is my endurance phase. And as soon as we got to the first hill, he would just stay at 200 watts and he would just be half an hour behind, sticking to his program, doing what. And I remember thinking to myself, who does this guy think he is? How does he know what he's doing? And then it was only a couple of years later or a year later, I thought, how's the balls on this guy? He's just, and once you started showing your true colors in the racing, I thought, this guy's got it worked out. He's like, confidence, he knows what to do. And it was really refreshing to see a young guy who didn't get caught up in the game and knew what he wanted to do. Now, what I want to ask you is, Was that just a complete fluke, or was that true about your personality? You really are calculated and you're comfortable in your own judgment.
Yeah, that's funny you bring it up. I had the story also from Simon Clark, which I again were teammates with on EF last year. At the time, I think I didn't think about it at all. Yeah, I think the training camp started in November and going into December. And many of you guys had the nationals coming up, Down Under, and other races, where I was brought in just to see Australia, and meet the team as well. But the program for me was set to start same as I've done before on continental level. I think last weekend of February or first weekend of March maybe. So I had also a training camp in South Africa in January and one in February in Spain. So I had a long time to get in shape. Yeah, at the time I didn't think about it being so crazy that I just wanted to ride, because that was what I always did in November and December. No efforts, just base miles, the same low watts. And I remember it was a little bit of a fight we had, Dave
McPartland
there, and I remember my coach had spoken with him and they were all happy. You can just ride. And I think most days it was not a problem. We did many loops that was like out and back on a big mountain. So all you guys would make it to the top, and I would just turn around when you came back down. But then after two or three days, he was pushing me again and saying, maybe you should do these efforts. And I was like, you spoke with my coach. It's all fine. Yeah, that's fine. And then it would be two or three days, he would come again and say, maybe you can do the efforts today.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I love that. The confidence was there, but you can probably see now, being professional for probably, I don't know, close to 10 years now, if you think about a Neo Pro coming in now and doing something like you, maybe you would think, oh wow, this could be interesting. Especially, not especially, but if they don't go on to do something, then it's especially like, what the hell does this guy know? You went on to become who you are now, which that's what I want to talk about now. Second year in Green Edge, the first year in Green Edge, you're sort of finding your feet. And I want to just jump straight to the second year, and more specifically to the Vuelta España. You had your first professional win. Well, you weren't exactly in Green Edge then. You were in the national team and you won a stage of Tour of Denmark. So do you call that your first pro win?
My first pro win, I would say, already in 2013.
In Colt. Yes, yeah. Okay.
I had four wins there.
Well, then the first World Tour win, I'll get around that. Yeah. Okay. First World Tour win, let's go straight to the Vuelta, and this is a pretty epic win. I've recently just watched the backstage pass of it when I was doing a bit of research, and what I love about this win is the team wasn't really focused on you. You'd had a couple results early on, a third in another sprint, but is this something that works for you? And I'm working with you over the last few years, I think it is something that when you're a bit more of an underdog, or there is another objective in the team, there's a little bit of support for you, but there's not a massive big entourage around you. You've left to do your own thing. This is sort of the case at stage 18 in the Vuelta. They were looking after Chavez there. There was a lot of objectives, and from what I understand, you can tell the story. You even were trying to set up Chavez before the sprint, hold him out of the wind, till 5K to go, and then you went, I might just have a go at this sprint, full bunch sprint. And you won the bunch sprint. Tell me about how it happened, but then also about the actual emotion of winning your first Grand Tour stage and that feeling of, I've arrived on the big stage.
Yeah. First of all, I think you are right that sometimes it feels like the wins I have, they fall a little bit random down from the sky, and I grab them there. It's not always it has worked setting it up. I also have some wins where it has been the plan the whole day. But that stage 18 was definitely not the plan. There have been a few other sprint days earlier in the race, and third on one stage, and then some bad luck. And so in the end, we had two guys up in GC with Chavez and one of the Yates brothers. And I was sitting with AG. We were kind of doing a thing, and the other guys kind of had Chavez. He was or he finished third at least, and Yeji was finished fifth. There was already that little time difference between the two of them. So the young guys stayed together, and then the rest of the team kind of had their thing. But I was specifically told not to sprint. I think we had a sprint day the day before, or maybe it was 2 days before, where I still had the aero suit on, with small like hope of doing something. But it's warm, and if you have to get bottles, and then you prefer to have a normal jersey. So for stage 18, I had the normal jersey. Didn't expect anything. And then the positioning with these guys just went really well. I didn't use too much energy coming in, and I think around 3Ks to go, I could see I was sitting in good position with Yeji on my wheel, and Chavez was also in good position, and he still had Bewley and maybe Swine Toft, and like I think they also had a good run, so I was thinking, I'll just leave him here and then do my own thing for the last 2 or 3 Ks, because I was already in the front and I hadn't really touched the wind too much, and somehow it worked out with a win, and then everybody was happy. Nobody is talking about that. I've got specifically told not to sprint.
But I love this, because this is something I try and give some people advice if they've asked, but when you get your chance, you got to take it regardless of the consequences. You got to be willing to take on, if it doesn't happen, you got to be willing to go, well, just say you'd finished 10th or 15th and, you know, someone had crashed and then everything would have gone to shit and you would have got your ass kicked. But you got to be willing to take your chance and go, well, I'm going to have to wear it if it doesn't work today. And that's what you did, but it came off, and everyone's always happy when it comes off.
Yeah, I think you have to be really careful when you do something like that, like making sure that I've done at least my job until the 3K sign. So time should be, there's no more time gaps in GC, and then you can look into it. I was going really well, also climbing very well, so that was probably why I felt now I just give it a crack. I was feeling good, because sometimes in a bunch sprint you also sit already on max heart rate
anyway
at 3K out now anyway, and you almost have nothing to sprint with. But if you're sitting there at 3K to go, still like fairly relaxed, it's a bike race, it's going fast, but if you still have something left, then that's a good sign, and you kind of know, okay, this is a chance, and then you need to take that.
What was it like, first of all, for you when you won, that feeling of like, oh, I just won? And then secondly, what was the team's reaction, more so what was Steve-O's reaction like?
Yeah, I think everybody was very, very happy. I don't remember when I saw Steve-O the first time. Sometimes when you win, it can take a while before you see the sports director, because the cars go out on deviation in the last minute, and I will be on the finish line and then on the podium. But I think I remember Matthew White, our head sports director, was there, because he was living really close.
Oh, that's right.
So, yeah. So I think I saw him, and obviously he was very happy also. So it was great to see him. And yeah.
What about you?
No, it was good. I think it's something you really have dreamed of as a kid. It's now a win on not only the first win on the world tour, but in a grand tour. Mm. It's really getting up there with the big wins. Yeah, it was only my second win as a professional rider. I won in the national kit in Tour of Denmark a few weeks earlier. It's also big to do it for your actual team.
So now the next big thing for you was the tour. In 2018, you move across to Astana and you start really well after a pretty troublesome year in 2017. 2017, you have a big crash in Yorkshire, break your collarbone, and I remember your comeback, because it was in Ride London. We actually rode for you there, and you got second in the sprint there. Did this great lead out, came around, and Christoph ended up pipping you in the finish. And what was that year like, 2017, and that transition into Astana? What happened at the end there with Greenedge? It was just time to move on, you're ready for a change. Was that troublesome year had anything to do with it? What was that shift there?
Yeah, obviously I broke the collarbone. That takes some time to heal, but I don't remember it as a so troublesome year. I think it was going okay, but obviously after I've done so well in the world say the year before, not only winning but also climbing the best I've ever been climbing at that time. Yeah, maybe you could hope for more than what I got out of 17. There was some good results like that second place in Ride London Classic, which is still my best result in a one day race on the world tour.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've only won one day race, but that was not a world tour level one day race. I think actually at 17 I got really well off. I started winning there and in the Tour of Valencia also a stage. So in February I really came in strong, but then was maybe lacking a little bit. And I don't know, it wasn't me that I wanted to change, but I think Orica was or Mitchelton they were struggling a little bit with the budget, and obviously I was worth a bit more now with my two stage wins in the world. So I had to find somewhere else.
And somewhere else you did, because you started, you know, you started hot running at Astana. In Oman, you had a stage win, also a stage win in Yorkshire, and then you went into the tour. And this is a pretty cool win. I remember watching this. Two guys in the breakaway. It was quite a big break. It got whittled down, and you had your fellow countryman there, Michael Valgren, who's now our teammate as well. You guys were in this break at the end of the tour, and the attacks were going. And you followed this attack. Birka Mollema hits out with about 8K to go. You'd already followed another attack before. You follow Mollema, and next thing you know, you get away with him and Izaguirre. You guys coming into the line. On paper, it's obvious what was going to happen there, in my eyes. You're a pretty quick sprinter, obviously winning that bunch sprint in the Vuelta just 2 years ago. Proper bunch sprint. What was it like for you, though? Is it just that simple, or was it now suddenly coming to you like, this is a chance to win a stage of the Tour de France? This isn't just a Grand Tour, this is a Tour. This is something that most kids dream of riding. Then having a position to be in a chance of winning a stage, and then suddenly going, oh, I can really win this. What was those last sort of 8K like, when you sort of realised Valgren was back there blocking for you, the gap was open, you're with Mollema, who's a strong guy but not a sprinter, Izaguirre can be dicey, but you're probably going to wrap him up. Run me through those final Ks, what that feeling was like, and when you sort of realised, oh, I'm going to win this.
Yeah, as you said, we were two teammates with Michael Valgren also. We were riding for Astana, and it had been a typical breakaway day from kilometer zero or before. You knew from reading the road book that it would be a breakaway, a hard day with a mountain in the middle, but a flat finish. And the break had been cut in, so we were seven or eight guys, I think, in the final group who had to ride for it on the flat roads. And we were told in the radio, me and Michael, we had the Danish sports director Lars Mikkelsen behind us. Cheering on us in Danish, he was telling us, this is our win. We have to win it, and he didn't care how we did it, as long as we won. we were not riding for second, because this is what you can end up doing, I think, in a situation like that. You're attacking a bit, you're coming away with one or two other guys, and you're like, okay, this is good. If I just ride hard, they won't catch it from behind, and then I'm secure on getting something. A podium. I'm getting something. But we both knew that we were not riding for something. We had to win. Yeah. There was no other choice than the win was the only option. Yeah, so we were attacking a bit, and I get away in that three-man group, as you said, and I was feeling good still. It had been a hard day, but I was on top of the pedals. I knew, like, I have the legs. I knew I had a sprint. Sometimes it's something you can feel. At the end of a bike race, sometimes, you know, oh, I'm tired, but I was like, yeah, there's a sprint in the legs.
Yeah, I'm still good. Yeah.
I knew I have a sprint.
And how were those boys looking? Were they looking like, oh, because Mollema attacked first. Was it a hard attack to get across to? Were there any moments where you're like, oh, these guys are, oh, they're going good, or they just felt pretty crap?
I don't think they felt crap, but but like this big selection had happened on a climb, and now we were down on the flat roads, where me and Michael was probably the strongest guys on a flat finish like that. So having another teammate and already on a terrain that suits you really well was good. And sitting with those two guys coming in the last few Ks, I kind of have the final prepared. There's only so many things that can happen. Like they can attack or they can stop pulling, or if you just know exactly what you're doing, so you don't have to think about it in the moment when it happens. So I knew, okay, if one of them goes, I close him straight away, because then it's not so hard to close an attack compared to if.
And then they get the gap, and then you're
if
like,
one get a gap, and I'm looking at Isagira, and Isagira is looking at me, and Molema is at the same time just hammering on the pedals. Then he'll be a hard man to shut down. But if you know straight away if he's going, I'm just there in his wheel. Yeah. No questions asked. And I think also they could feel it, probably that.
Did they attack? I didn't actually see.
No, nobody attacked. So that was also a bit weird. Normally, if you're not a strong sprinter, at least you just have to do it to say you tried. If you're going to lose the sprint, and then it's not going to hurt your sprint that much, just try something. Like, you can't be lucky that they're sitting looking at each other.
Seems like they were pretty happy just to get second or third.
Yeah, I think Molema, he definitely didn't have a good sprint, so it seemed like he was happy just to ride it in for the podium.
And Isagire?
I think he came up with a good sprint. I just had a better one.
Yeah. Led out from the front, and those guys got nowhere. What was that like? Tour de France stage, you're like, wow, it's happened.
Yeah, that was insane. Yeah, I just took the front, and looking back, I was feeling the strongest, and so I didn't want any of them in my way, almost. It was really big, because even though the world is big, it's a Grand Tour, the Tour is it's a different level. It is bigger to win a one-day race, but I think maybe for the normal, not like bike-interested person, then the winning a stage in the Tour is
means everything.
That means everything. That's bigger than the big one-day races. They don't really know those, but if you say, oh, I won a stage in the Tour, they'll be like, oh, shit, he is.
Except for Roubaix. Roubaix trumps everything, I think.
Yeah, it does, like, in the world of cycling, but you'll meet people on the street. They don't know Roubaix, but everybody knows the Tour. And
that's true.
Not only I've been in the Tour, but I've won a stage there. It's a big thing. It's also something that's never gets old. I think I have that for the rest of my life. If I won, I think, four stages, if two of Denmark, but okay, it's good, but it's not. Mm. Yeah, now some years ago, and yeah, whatever. No,
but the tour
stays with you. Yeah.
Let's talk about current days. Now we're back together at EF. A couple of years at Astana, and then you decided to come across to EF. I left Green Edge and came across to EF, and it really did feel. And Jens Kukulé also came across. He had 2 years at Lotto, a good friend of ours. We're all together at Mitchelton, Green Edge, Orica, whatever you want to call it. And then we all met back up at EF, and it really, I don't know about you, but it really didn't feel like we'd been away from each other. It was a funny thing, these bonds we created back in that team, it just felt like we just weren't on the same program for 2 years, and then all of a sudden we're back in the same team. How's your feeling been now across this team, and the direction you want to go yourself? You've moved away from the Cobble Classics a little bit, you're starting to find out who you are as a rider, as you just sort of alluded there, you're a guy that needs or likes to have a bit of tension on the legs in the peloton. You personally, but also the other riders. Once the other riders get tired, it seems like to me you come into your own. This year, a great example in Paris-Nice. This was an amazing stage win when everyone was very, very tired and it seemed like you were just still doing the same old thing. What are you starting to discover about yourself now in the third team of your career? What are you learning about yourself, and what sort of direction do you see yourself going coming up now with Magnus?
Yeah, the direction for me, that's also something I've been looking into and thinking a bit about. I've the first many years as professional, I've done the Cobble Classics, and that's the ones I wanted to do. I see them as the biggest races. But that's not where I've had my results when I look back. So looking at that, I was thinking, okay, maybe I should try and focus a bit more on where I actually have done the best. It's in stages, in stage races, and and then in grand tours. So coming to EF, that was a bit of the plan. Not going for the couple classics, but a bit more stage races, a bit more of these stages with intermediate stages where you can't really say it's not a pure sprint. Maybe it's a breakaway, and it's really hard.
Also, hard main stack.
It's hard to also predict what's happening, but. If I'm there at the end of a day, whether it's maybe a breakaway or a reduced bunch, then I have a good chance normally. But it's also really a hard days to predict, and it can be difficult also for a team to control and set up correctly.
Where is Magnus Cort going to live when he finishes cycling? Are you going to end up back at the island? What's your plan, mate? You're now in Andorra. And then you go back to Denmark sometimes. Sometimes you're in Spain. You're all around the place. Where are you going to end up? You're going to be back on the island? What's the future hold for Magnus?
Yeah, I don't know. I think for now I don't have a girlfriend or a wife. So I think that can really change the picture suddenly if she comes in and has an opinion of her own. Then maybe I follow. Otherwise, I think I could end up on the island back on Bornholm when I retire. I still haven't learned any Spanish or Catalan, so that's pretty impressive. I think after
join the club, I'm horrible.
Yeah, I really have done a bad integration here, but. So I don't think I will be living there after my career. I really like it. For the training is great in both in Spain and Andorra. And that was like the main reason. Also, there's a lot of bike riders I can go training with. But I think if I stop cycling, I lose all of that, and then I'm left in a country where I can't really speak to a lot of people.
Nice, mate. Well, it's been nice to get to know you today. I hope everyone's enjoyed understanding what ticks, what's behind the glasses. So thanks for being on the pod, mate.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, there we have it. Magnus Cort Nielsen, a little insight to his life before he was a cyclist, or as he grew up as a cyclist, but more importantly, his life now as a pro and what he's achieving. And I think he's still got so much more to come in his career. I thought it was really exciting to find out a little bit about a different side to the pro peloton there. What do you think, Lionel?
Yeah, well, first of all, it made me look at the map of Denmark, because the number of little islands around the mainland of Denmark. And of course, next year is going to be huge, isn't it, for Danish cycling, because the Tour de France, the Grand Départ, will be in Copenhagen, delayed, of course, because of the pandemic. But fingers crossed, we'll all be in Denmark for the start of the Tour de France in 2022, and that will be a big year. I'm sure he'll be wanting to be on the start line there. There's a real big Danish contingent now in the peloton. I think there were 11 Danes in the Tour de France this year, weren't there? So it's a big country. And as I was talking to Daniel Freeb on the regular cycling podcast, and he was talking about the intensity of the media spotlight from the Danes. Lots of TV crews and news crews and journalists from Denmark follow cycling. More Danes covering the tour than Slovenians, which you know might sound a bit strange considering Pogacar has been dominant this year. A big cycling nation, Denmark. So it's interesting to hear about Magnus's journey from the beginning into the pro sport. And it just made me think about your experience on this side of the fence, Mitch. And I wondered what you made of how little of the actual race the journalists get to see because of all the ground they have to cover. I mean, and whether you've thought at a Grand Tour, you know, you sometimes see the same journalist at the start and at the finish, you know, you've ridden 200 kilometres in between and you've probably not visualised what their day's been like, but now you know.
It's funny you say that, because as a cyclist, you think you're sort of going along at a sort of slow pace in comparison to a car or whatever that may be. But actually, it's pretty tight. By the time you see the riders off, you're behind the riders and they have the direct route, obviously an open road, the route that they go on. And for you to get around that route and get to the finish, you have to do some big loop. And it's quite difficult even to get there much time before the finish of the race. It seems ridiculous. You're like, hang on, these guys are riding bikes, yet I can't even get in a car and get there much time before they ride there. By the time you get in the traffic and you get stuck behind this and that and go on a big loop, it blew me away how big the Tour de France is outside of the race. Really huge. And you need to, everyone says it, and you need to see it for yourself. First time for me, how much the roads were blocked off, how much, you know, like I said, without that gold pass, you know, or the golden sticker on the car, you can't get anywhere. So it was really interesting to see that. Also, like you just said, with the Danes, a massive Danish media around the Danish riders. They're doing so well. There's such a big presence in the peloton, and they're really heavily followed. You see all the Danes come up at the start of the race. They go straight across to the TV, do their interviews there, and it's almost like it's pre-organized. Like you said, they contact the media managers from each team who organize them to come over there. So if you, by the time they finish with the TV, you're lucky enough to get a little snippet. Michael Morkov, of course, is very good to come across, and he's really interesting to talk to as well. And just a little idea of how big they are in their own country, I think, cycling as a nation. It's very popular over there.
And what about the journey around? Well, your part was, I guess, kicked off in Andorra somewhere. You know very well, of course, because you're based a lot of the time there. But then the journey up to Paris, I guess you saw, what life is like for not just the media, but also everyone else who's working on the race that just doesn't happen to be in a team bubble. You know, there's so many people, isn't there? You know, whether it's the race organisers and you know, often you'll see people from the Tour de France organisation in restaurants or whatever, if you're staying in big towns particularly. But just like you say, that the size of the race is something that, until you see it, you can't quite get your head around. And it's another level beyond the Giro even, isn't it? Just the size of the Tour de France.
Another level, you know, and it, again, you don't realize, I probably don't realize how big the Giro is because I've never traveled around the outside of it, always been inside the cycling bubble. And like I said, the path is cleared for you and you go directly to the hotel, the riders are number one. So you don't really get an idea of how big those races are until you come as either a fan or as someone on the outside. I think something that also was interesting for me was you just imagine you're going to see everyone who works on this race, you know, maybe see Bradley Wiggins, or maybe I'll see Simon Gerrans, who's doing some commentary. I didn't see any of those people. You know, it's so big. There's such a big amount of people involved in this. They can be in some hotel 50K away, and the next day, another hotel 20K away. You just don't see them. Yes, you do see the other media sort of journalists who are in the mix zone there, and you strike up a good relationship with them and sort of maybe try and race them to the end of the race, or, you know, see where they're going to have dinner that night, which is a really nice atmosphere as well. I think part of it is also enjoying being on tour and making it is work, but making it enjoyable work. And I think that's being portrayed really well in the cycling podcast, is that it's a journey for us too, and you're coming on the journey with us, traveling the tour and experiencing the culture, and that's part of it as well. And I think it'd be really silly to do it the other way and make it into a small Ibis hotel and, you know, go straight to the start, straight to the finish. Hang on, we're traveling around France too. You know, just I love that part too. And I try and do that as much as I can as a writer, which is probably about 5% compared to what you get to do as a journalist. I think it's really important to, you know, take it all in as well.
Yeah, I mean, these races are, you know, 3-week long adverts for the countries that host them. And it's why foreign cities such as Copenhagen next year pay so much money to host the starts of the Grand Tours, isn't it? It's an opportunity for people to see these countries, almost the work that the tourist boards, you know, they can't really do. They can reach parts that conventional advertising maybe doesn't. And all of that culture, the cuisine, and well, I was going to say, Mitch, you put your own stamp on it by introducing the craft beer element, which is something that France is so well known for its fantastic wine, but there's a real growing craft beer industry in France, and it was great to basically have a week of the cycling brewcast. I'm hoping that we may get that again in the future. I hope it won't be your last stint on a Grand Tour for us.
No, I would love to come back, and I thought it was funny to introduce that. And the craft beer scene was out of control in the Pyrenees. I loved it. There was just so much beer around, too much beer to drink. Well, I don't know if that's correct, but there was a lot of beer around. I'd love to come back, and I hope everyone enjoyed hearing my voice on that format. Got some great feedback. So I did want to also say, seeing as we're talking about Denmark, I was actually up just before I did this up in Sweden, very close. I actually flew out of Copenhagen in the end to come back. I did this event called The Length of Sweden. I was talking about it before I went up there. And that is going to be, well, just to give you a quick idea of that is literally what it sounds like. I started in the very top of Sweden and rode to the very bottom. It's almost like it is a beret event where you just, everyone heads off at their own time. Takes them, some guys do it in 4 days. It took me 7 days to do it, and it was a real journey, an amazing experience. I met so many great people along the way, and I actually took a little microphone with me and did some recordings along the way. That is going to be my next episode of Life in the Peloton. It's a slightly different Peloton, but I just thought, you know what, this bike packing, this adventuring scene is sort of exploding at the moment. And I thought, well, how about I give you a little insight to what it's like being on the road and why these people do this? Why people go out, even do it on their own, ride all night, ride for all these hours, and why other people do it like the way I did it, ride, you know, 10 hours a day and sleep in a hotel. Why are we doing this stuff? What are we getting out of this? And I interviewed some people along the way. Going to put that together for you next time. That'll be in 2 weeks' time. But if you enjoyed Magnus now, the Talking Loof series is up and running again. I've done a Talking Loof with Magnus. That'll be across at Life in the Peloton next week. So make sure you tune in with that. And guys, if you haven't seen already on social media, the Life in the Peloton kit is out in the world. I've actually seen one kit rolling around in person, which was pretty cool. So make sure you keep looking out for that. And if you do want to get that, there is still some coming over on the raffle website. That'll be coming in the next few weeks. So keep your eyes ready for that. And guys, once again, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy Life in the Peloton being back. So guys, thanks very much for tuning in. And until next time, cheers. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.